Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a full-page ad from the giant tech companies in Monday's New York Times and Washington Post, calling on the President and Congress to rein in the NSA. Mark Rotenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, joins us to discuss the call for tighter controls on government surveillance in an open letter from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo, and the international blowback from NSA spying that is hurting American business. Then we'll look into the growing backlash against the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership deal and the latest internal memo leaked by someone in one of the 12 governments involved in the secret negotiations. Laurie Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss leaks on trade standards that would grant unprecedented powers to corporations, increase the cost of medications, and weaken banking regulations. We'll also look into whether an agreement on the TPP can be reached by the end of the year, as international support for it appears to be waning. Then finally, with Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel in Pakistan threatening to cut military assistance if local officials continue to block supply routes extracting heavy equipment from Afghanistan, we will speak with Michael Crapon, the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Program. We'll discuss the role of the former cricket star turned party leader Imran Khan, who is threatening to unleash mass protests to block NATO supply routes in retaliation against U.S. drone strikes. And joining us now is Mark Rotenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice speaking with you.
And Mark, what did you make of this full-page letter that appeared in both the New York Times and the Washington Post? It has a website attached to it. It comes from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo, issuing an open letter to both the President and the Congress, urging them to make reforms in NSA surveillance and generally increase transparency and independent oversight. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. Clearly, there's a need to strengthen privacy laws in the United States. We've all been reading the almost weekly reports from Mr. Snowden about the true extent of surveillance by the National Security Agency. There have been hearings in Washington, and I think an important debate broadly about how we recapture some of the privacy that was lost in response to 9/11 when so many of these new surveillance systems were put in place. So as a general matter, I think the Internet companies are right to say we need to strengthen privacy laws. But, of course, you do need to look into the details now and ask the question, what exactly is it that the companies are backing and what is it that we really need? And my view is that there's still a long way to go to establish the kinds of privacy protections that should be established. The Internet companies, I think, have a pretty modest agenda, one that doesn't really address the core concerns that most Internet users have.
Well, there's reports so far indicate, though, that these Internet companies, and particularly the telco companies like AT&T and Verizon, get paid to cooperate with the NSA to basically get their metadata. But it seems like the NSA maybe went too far as far as these companies are concerned by tapping into their clouds. Is that what pushed them over the edge?
Well, I think particularly for the Internet firms, and most notably Google, Yahoo, and then Microsoft, the realization that the government was collecting data from them not only through the channels that had been established between the companies and the government, but also truly backdoor by going directly to servers and going directly to network communications, probably did lead the companies to conclude that they had a very serious problem. They needed to work together to establish stronger privacy safeguards. Now, I will say, again, from the user perspective, we have been urging these companies for many years to put in place better technologies for privacy, to routinely encrypt communications, to encrypt stored data, to minimize data collection where possible, to delete personal data where possible. And for the most part, they didn't show very much interest in all of that, not until they realized that it was their own servers and their own networks that were under attack. So they're a little late to the party, I would say. We welcome them, but there's a lot more that needs to happen to address these key concerns.
So isn't there blowback across both the economic and political landscape around the world? We certainly know about the political blowback from Snowden's revelations, I believe, only 1% of which have been made public so far. If that's 1%, God knows what the 99% is going to do. But my understanding is that there is a real blowback in terms of foreign companies wondering about doing business in the United States. The reason the Germans were so upset about the NSA revelations, they didn't care whether the NSA were finding out what Angela Merkel ordered on her sandwiches. They were really upset that they were tapping into trade negotiations, etc. So is this having a detrimental effect on American business or on foreign businesses doing business with America?
Well, I think that's the subtext, in fact, of the letter that the Internet firm sent to the president and to members of Congress. They were calling for new forms of transparency and accountability and some limitations on NSA access to customer data. But they were also communicating the very strong concern that a lot of business, particularly in the cloud-based computing model, which is essentially remote services, large businesses and universities that used to keep their data in-house are now being encouraged to move it to providers who keep it off-site and process the data that way. It's that cloud-based model that's so critical to the future of the Internet and the growth of many firms that's now come under close scrutiny by foreign businesses and foreign governments because they're saying, you know, if we put this data online with these U.S. firms, the NSA is going to get access to all that, and we have real concerns. So I think the letter was saying, given that pressure that the companies are now facing from potential customers overseas to do a better job on privacy, that it is very much an economic issue, and that's in part why they want to see the privacy law strengthened.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberty issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. And beyond the concerns about the clouds, because I think people thought that the stuff was encrypted on the way in, but they didn't realize that the NSA were tapping into the clouds themselves, right?
Well, that's right. And as I said earlier, I think that's what got the Internet firms particularly upset, because they realized that the arrangements that they believe they had in place with the government to establish certain practices for transferring data just weren't being respected. In other words, the NSA had found ways to gain access to the communications between Google servers and were collecting user data in that way. But again, you know, many of the privacy organizations that have been pushing for many years to strengthen the protections for users had warned the companies that they weren't doing enough to safeguard privacy. And I think we're also perplexed that in many of the debates over updating privacy laws, both in the U.S. and in Europe, many of these same companies were oftentimes on the opposite side of the debate. They would say, we don't need new legislation. Self-regulation is doing fine. If people don't like what one business is doing, they can go to another business. So they spend quite a bit of time trying to reassure policymakers in Washington that there was no need to update legislation. Of course, now that they find that their own data is vulnerable to collection by the government, they've changed their position. So we're glad, of course, that they understand how very important it is to update these privacy laws, but I think it's also important to understand that ultimately it's the user's data that's at issue. It's not just the data that the companies manage. It's the personal information that's provided by the user.
But that's where there's a certain amount of ambiguity, isn't it? Because these companies like Facebook and Yahoo mine your personal information. That's how they make money. So this is a bit like the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it?
Well, it certainly creates a dilemma in the sense that on the one hand, they want protections from government access and use of the data they gather. On the other hand, they don't want any restrictions as to how they use the data that they've obtained from the users. And our view is that because it is ultimately the user's data, that we need privacy laws that both protect the companies against improper access by government, and we favor that. But we also need some limitations on the collection and use of the data that the companies are gathering, because users don't have a meaningful way to limit the use of that data once the companies acquire it. And not surprisingly, people are becoming increasingly frustrated, you know, about the loss of privacy. They're being told routinely that you really can't expect privacy anymore when you go on the Internet. But, of course, in many ways, that doesn't make any sense at all, because people have no understanding of what information is being collected or how it's being used. So for all these reasons, we think a comprehensive privacy law that incorporates some of the elements that the Internet companies have recommended, as well as some elements that others have proposed, is the best way to go.
But isn't there also an issue here of monetizing this information? In other words, Google and Facebook and these other high-tech companies that wrote this letter, which is in the New York Times and full-page New York Times and Washington Post, urging the President and the Congress to rein in the NSA, they essentially, their business model is to monetize private data on their users. And I'm wondering if there could be a user revolt at some point where users basically say, wait a minute, that's my information. I should be being paid. You should be making money out of me. I mean, you know, we have those cards that you have at supermarkets that give you a discount because they see you as a valuable customer. And likewise, airlines give you mileage, you know, travel mileage. So there's no question that the individual has value, but the individual doesn't get that value. The data mining company gets the value.
Right. Well, that's been, of course, a long-running debate about the Internet economy and what exactly it is, you know, that's generating the value. I don't think there's any dispute that the services are quite useful and people appreciate them, but at the same time, there seems to be almost an unbounded collection and use of sensitive personal information for commercial purposes. And when users have tried to organize in the past and make some of these points, and I will say that my organization, EPIC, has been involved in some of those campaigns, one of the remarkable and disheartening facts is that the companies often move quickly to dismantle the mechanisms by which users join together to raise legitimate objections. So, for example, several years ago when Facebook proposed to change its terms of service to allow a broader commercial use of user data, Facebook users created a group called Facebook Users against the new terms of service. And more than 150,000 Facebook users signed up. Well, not long after that campaign, Facebook took down the group and prevented groups in the future from using the name Facebook in any other groups that might be established on the online platform. These are subtle changes. They're not, you know, part of the prominent part of Internet history, but I think they need to be understood because they do speak to the increasing difficulty that users are having trying to exercise their rights in these new online environments.
So Mark Rotenberg, again, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. Another part of the blowback that I understand that's happening is in terms of chips that the Chinese are now, who manufacture most of our chips, I believe, they're concerned that there is a sort of trapdoor, a backdoor in chips that go to the NSA. And then likewise, the U.S. would boycott Chinese manufactured chips because they would assume that there's a backdoor to their signals intelligence. And of course, as we know, China has tremendous and ubiquitous surveillance of its citizens.
Yes, well, this has always been a concern, I would say, you know, on all sides of the high-tech debate where countries are increasingly aware that new devices have tremendous capacity to capture sensitive information and to provide it to the intelligence agency of the host country where the device is manufactured. Over time, I think the view of technologists is that to the extent that more of the code is public and available for scrutiny, the less likely those kinds of problems are likely to arise. Certainly, whenever you're dealing with a proprietary technique, there is some risk that something has been inserted, perhaps on the instigation of an intelligence agency that users or people in other countries would not be aware of. Here again at EPIC, we've had a number of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits over the years where we've tried to make public some of those arrangements because we do believe that user trust is best established when people have the ability to actually examine and test the code of the devices on which they rely.
So my reading of this open letter in Monday's New York Times and Washington Post, and there's a website that goes along with it, and this is a letter from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo to both the President and the Congress to rein in the NSA. There aren't really any specifics here, are they? It feels kind of like a wish list. Where's the expression?
Well, they have five specific proposals. I think they are somewhat vague, but they're still be understood in Washington as specific recommendations with regard to the transparency and the accountability of government access to the information that the companies maintain. And I think on those points, the privacy groups will probably agree that that makes some sense because it will make it more difficult for the government to get access to sensitive personal information. On a couple of the other points, I think there may be less agreement. For example, the internet companies are very concerned about regional clouds, which Europe is talking about, Asian countries, South American countries are talking about. They do see that as a potential loss of business. Our view is that it depends entirely on whether or not the jurisdiction where the service is being provided offers sufficient privacy protection. And if it doesn't, and another jurisdiction says privacy protection is important to us and we're going to enforce it, then we think regional clouds would be good. And as for their last point, I believe that they're recommending some unified approach to processing the requests they receive from multiple governments. That may or may not be good for user privacy. We've pushed for a comprehensive privacy framework, which begins by saying that if the government is going to collect information about users anywhere in the world, there should be a clear legal standard to protect the users, which is, again, a different emphasis. It's more about protecting the user interests than trying to accommodate the firms.
But what about the companies that actually make the technology for these new platforms like these clouds? Apparently, Amazon has taken the lead in this, and I believe now Google is trying to catch up. Is there any concern about at the manufacturing level?
Well, the cloud technology is really a storage technique, mm-hmm. and the primary concern does have to do with the access by the National Security Agency to the private information. It can be user data, it can be proprietary business information that's being stored by the cloud service provider. And to be fair, I mean, there are enormous economies in cloud-based services and some innovation that probably wouldn't be possible in the traditional localized model for providing computing. But as attractive as those features may be, there is still the consideration that if the information that's being stored by Amazon or by Cisco or by some other firm is routinely accessible to the U.S. National Security Agency, then many companies, particularly outside of the United States, are going to be less likely to use those services.
And that's the problem, isn't it? That's what's affecting U.S. business, is the notion that they're either in complicity or vulnerable to the NSA.
Well, that's exactly the problem. And unless the companies are able to establish more clearly that they do have strong privacy standards in place that are backed up by law, they will likely lose business. I mean, that process is already underway with many companies in the United States citing concerns about the NSA surveillance as leading to a reduction in market share. Again, our view is that if more had been done earlier to strengthen privacy laws, this would be less of a problem today. But it is a problem today in part because of the dramatic expansion of the surveillance capabilities of the NSA post 9/11. It's also a problem because there's been enormous reluctance in Washington to update U.S. privacy laws. So I think to some extent, not completely, of course, but I think the Internet firms could have done more sooner to show support for privacy protection.
But I guess in closing, I suppose better late than never, right?
Well, yes. And as I said, I mean, we welcome them to the party. It's a little late, right. But there's a lot still to do. And if we can take a broad approach to the protection of privacy, including both elements that they have set out in their letter, as well as many other goals that users would support, I think we will end up with better privacy safeguards.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, as the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberty issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the leaks of the secret negotiations in the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome, or just hanging around old Shanghai. Danger is my logo, espionage and go-go. I'm just digging this American crime. I gave on the slip.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Wallach.
Thank you.
And these latest leaks that come from somebody inside one of the 12 governments involved in these secret negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership certainly are, and we spoke just recently about an earlier round of leaks. So just in terms of the mechanics of these secret negotiations, which they were going on in Salt Lake, and now they're going on in Singapore. Obviously, there's some dissent within the ranks, wouldn't you say?
Well, the leaks were very revealing. First of all, there's a chart. I've never seen anything like it, but lists every country's position on 4 pages of issues that are unresolved. And then there's a memo that was prepared for the minister of whatever country it was going into this ministerial meeting, which was the last-ditch moment to finish the TPP by its 2013 deadline declared by the Obama administration as the do-or-die. And what it revealed, among other things, is there are a lot of contested issues that go to some of our basic rights and needs, jacking up medicine prices, limiting internet freedom, but also it showed the U.S. really bullying to push this whole set of corporate interests against, in many instances, united opposition from all of the other countries, which is really disappointing and fairly disgusting.
And these other countries are Australia, Brunei, Chile, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. And, of course, conspicuously absent is China, who the TPP appears to be almost organizing against, right?
Well, ostensibly, the Obama administration agenda, in part, is to isolate China. This is their part, the economic part of their pivot to Asia. But, actually, the previous Obama trade minister announced nothing would make him happier but for China to join. I think the idea is to use this agreement to lock in all over the Asian Pacific region these policies that are favorable to U.S. corporations. Unfortunately, those include a bunch of things Congress has said no to in the sunshine of public process, like SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, pieces of which similar policies would be enacted if the countries now opposing caved to the U.S. demands.
So some of these documents are redacted, and the U.S. Office of Trade the U.S. Trade Representative has said these are not U.S. documents. We have no idea of their authorship or authenticity. Some elements of them are outdated, others totally inaccurate. What do we know about how much we can rely on these documents?
We know they're an authentic document and a chart from a government that is clearly not the U.S. because a lot of the document talks about the U.S. bullying and the U.S. threatening. And it's clearly from a set of negotiators to their minister because it's instructing the minister of the political and policy issues. The piece of it that's, I guess, outdated is it was the document going into the negotiations that now are starting their fourth day. But what it reveals in a level of detail never before seen is the full range of fights and issues when this negotiation in Singapore started and how isolated the U.S. is and how systematically the U.S. is pushing all of these corporate agenda items. I might add, a bunch of which actually Congress objects to. I mean, they're pushing for a huge expansion of the duration of copyrights, which is something that's not been doable in Congress. The balance is fine. They're pushing for extensions of patents on medicines that would raise our medicine prices as well. They're pushing for an expansion of the controversial investor state system, where private corporations are elevated to the level of a government to privately enforce a public treaty by dragging our governments to private tribunals to demand compensation from us, the taxpayers, for policies that the companies, the foreign investors, don't like. All of that are issues that people in the United States have said they don't want is our policies. And so this has become a really insidious backdoor way for a lot of a corporate agenda that can't get done in sunshine to get done through the back door.
Again, I'm speaking with Laurie Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Now, these latest leaks from one of the governments involved in the secret negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Laurie, I don't know whether this is a clue to it, but one of the more egregious things, of course, is access to medicines. And you just mentioned they want to mandate new intellectual property rules that would grant pharmaceutical companies long-term monopolies over medications, thus preventing generics coming online. The U.S. are definitely is the one that's pushing for this. Australia and New Zealand have medical boards that allow the government to basically set prices, apparently the U.S. is trying to ban these national boards that, of course, would then lock in enormous profits for U.S. drug companies but drive up the price of pharmaceuticals both abroad and here at home. how do you explain this in the context of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, which is and all of the stuff that the Democrats have railed against with the prescription drug benefits? That, remember, they had put in restrictions, the Congress put in restrictions for the government couldn't bulk buy and couldn't negotiate prices with pharmaceuticals. It was a giveaway then to the pharmaceutical companies. This is, you know, the mother of all giveaways.
Best I can tell, this is the sneaky way that some of the interests in the Obama administration are trying to get done behind the American people's back what couldn't be achieved in Congress and what the public would not like. And it's much worse than bad legislation, because with these trade agreements, if they go into effect, not a word can be changed unless all the countries agree. So we would be locked into these retrograde policies forever. And while the Obama health care reform didn't include those pharmaceutical boards in a national level, today even a group of members of Congress sent out a letter saying, but wait, we use these kind of boards at the state level for Medicare and Medicaid. If the U.S. continues to push that agenda, which, by the way, all the other countries opposed, had gone away, and the leaked document reveals that the Obama administration just in right before Thanksgiving at a round of negotiations in Utah raised this issue again after all the other countries had said no way, no how. And how they're trying to bait countries into accepting it is trying to trade market access. So the U.S. says, we'll give you some more access for your dairy exports, New Zealand, if you agree to give away Pharmac, which is the name of their particular review board. Or for Australia, we'll give you some sugar benefits if you agree to give away the pharmaceutical pricing scheme that you have. And in those countries, there's strong opposition to this, but the negotiations are behind closed doors. So actually, it's very hard to track what's going on until this leak happened.
Well, it's very puzzling, though. When you say, you know, people inside the Obama administration are pushing this backdoor way to give away enormous powers to corporations and set prices and drive up costs of basics like pharmaceuticals for everybody on the planet, so that these companies, U.S. companies who are already making record profits, could make obscenely record profits. It's got to be these whoever's doing this is doing it obviously at the behest of these big companies. So this really opens up the question about, you know, what kind of a democracy do we have here? You know, I mean, if and particularly if they can pull this stuff off in secret through the back door, that's, you know, it's bad enough that they can buy the government through thanks to the Supreme Court because of Citizens United. They can buy it in the open, but apparently they're also trying to control it through the back door.
Here's the one piece of good news. Ultimately, none of these things can happen unless the U.S. Congress gives its authority, delegates away its constitutional authority over trade. There is one big thing we can all do. And that is, we can make sure that Congress reserves its constitutional authority so that these agreements only go into effect if Congress votes for them. So what we all as concerned citizens trying to preserve democracy can do is make sure that Congress does not allow what is called fast-track trade authority. That is a mechanism that was originally cooked up actually by Richard Nixon in the 70s to grab Congress's constitutional exclusive trade authority. And heartbreakingly, President Obama is now asking to revive this outdated, outrageous process, which basically skirts congressional review.
Well, that's how they got NAFTA through, wasn't it? Clinton got
exactly.
It through on fast track.
It's like a legislative luge run. It's only ever been used 16 times. It's used for all the really dangerous agreements that aren't really about trade, but are about all these corporate giveaways. And in the last 20 years, it's only been in effect for 5 years. It's very contested, both by Democrats and Republicans. So all of your listeners who are worried about this, the main thing to do is make sure that your member of the House of Representatives, Democrat or Republican, commits to you to oppose giving away their constitutional authority to save us from these backdoor attack trade agreements. And the great news is 2 weeks ago, 152 Democrats and 30 Republicans got together and said, we ain't doing it. We're not doing that anymore. Well, you need 218 votes in the House of Representatives to pass anything. So right there, about 180 votes saying no. So if folks do the work to get the next 50 members of Congress to actually stand up and say, we're keeping our authority to save you from that TPP mess, then whatever they sign, it never goes into effect. And given all the other countries really just want access into the U.S., which is why they're thinking about trading away all these important policies, if the U.S. Congress says no, then that's the end of it.
But we do have the model of NAFTA to look at here, and essentially what's going on here is that multinational companies are being granted powers greater than sovereign governments, because under NAFTA, we've seen how ExxonMobil, Dow Chemicals, and Eli Lilly have tried to overrule Canadian regulations on offshore oil drilling, fracking, pesticides, drug patents, etc. And if the TPP goes through, the language in that is even more favorable to multinational governments, making them greater than sovereign powers.
That's one of the things that this leak, which, folks, if you want to read through the documents, but also a sort of guided tour, go to our website, which is www.tradewatch.org. Right on the front page, just click on the latest information. It's the analysis of what was in those leaks. And one of the things we saw there, and you're exactly right, Ian, is the United States, pretty much totally isolated except for Japan, pushing to expand those corporate tribunals. Now, all of this stuff is horrible. Everything you care about is at stake. So for the corporations who are pushing it, this is the Christmas tree. Every single powerful corporate interest, the agribusiness monopolists, the drug and pharmaceutical companies that want to jack up prices, the oil and gas companies, the chronic job offshoring U.S. multinationals, the banksters. This is the one thing where there's a chapter of goodies for each of them. The flip side is it cooks everyone's goose. The word has to get out about this. These kind of agreements only succeed if people don't start screaming about them. It's been negotiated in secret, but a lot has started to leak. So if you go to exposethetpp.org, that's www.exposethetpp.org, you can see an overview of all the leaked documents and also information about what we know is in there. Passing the word to your friends and getting all of your friends to make sure Congress maintains its constitutional authority. And even if they make a deal in Singapore, which they're supposed to do, I don't think they'll make it, actually. So a lot of the other countries are saying, no way, we can't give this stuff away. But if they were to make a deal, it still doesn't exist unless Congress says they'll go for it. And that's where we all come in.
And again, what does it expose the TPP?
www.exposethetpp.org gives you the guided tour of TPP.
Thank you.
If you want to know about fast track, if you want to see if your member of Congress signed those big letters saying no fast track, if you want to see the leaked text, go to tradewatch.org. Either way, sign yourself up on the action alert parts of those websites so you can be updated. You'll know all the latest developments and when to take action.
Well, Laurie Wallach, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Laurie Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress scholars and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel's visit in Pakistan, where the local governments are threatening to cut the trade routes to extract the heavy equipment out of Afghanistan. And we'll look into that in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Crapon, the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration, on Capitol Hill, and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 17 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. And his latest, a collection of essays co-edited with Julia Thompson, is Deterrence, Stability, and Escalation Control in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Crapon.
Ian, it's good to be back.
And Michael, the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel's met with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. He's also met with the new head of the military, who's also General Sharif. There's no relationship. But apparently what's at stake here is that is for the U.S. and NATO to extract all of that enormous heavy war equipment, which they had to pay an arm and a leg to get in the first place through Pakistan into Afghanistan, and they have to get it out. Obviously, they don't want to leave all this equipment. I believe they're even destroying a lot of it in a country that is not exactly stable. And I take it that what Hagel was asking the Prime Minister to do was to somehow rein in Imran Khan, who runs a state or a party that's powerful in a state on the border there with Afghanistan, where he's threatening. Imran Khan, the cricket star turned political power broker, he's threatening to use mass demonstrations to close off these supply routes in retaliation to U.S. drone strikes.
Think of this analogy, which just came into my head as you were talking, Ian. But think of this fellow, Imran Khan, as Rand Paul. And Rand Paul makes statements, takes public postures that the leadership of his own party and the country do not push back against. This is kind of what is happening in Pakistan. Imran Khan's party is the third largest party. He only has a few dozen members of his party that have been elected to the National Assembly. And yet the prime minister is, and other political leaders in the country, are silent as Imran rails against the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and the military relationship between Pakistan and the United States.
But what game is he playing? Because, first of all, the drone strikes are secretly approved of, and the U.S. secretly cooperates with the Pakistanis. After all, a lot of these drones take off from Pakistani airfields. That a lot of the targeting is done in conjunction with Pakistan. So the Pakistani military are up to their elbows in the drone program. They just prefer to have the U.S. take all the heat for it. And, you know, Imran Khan has been very, very soft on the Taliban and these radicals, murderous radicals, who are destabilizing Pakistan and would turn it into another Taliban state. I mean, he got completely repudiated recently when there was that hideous massacre of Shiites and Christians in a church where he showed up and people ran him out of town. So what's his motive? Is he just a grandstander?
Well, there isn't any leading government official in the country that can defend drone strikes, even if they have the tacit support of the political and military leadership. The fellow who was killed in a drone strike that catapulted all of this into a standoff between the United States and Pakistan was somebody who had hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent Pakistanis murdered by his cohort. And as you say, Imran Khan doesn't talk about that. And people who hate the drone strikes don't talk about the people that they are directed against. Now, these strikes are so unpopular that the Pakistani officials did close the airfields where the drones were based, but they're operating from other airfields nearby across the border. And, you know, they take out leadership targets in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, but they also create great difficulties. And not all of the targets are leaders, Ian. One of the problems we're having with Afghanistan now is getting the president of the country to sign an agreement that provides protections, legal protections, of U.S. troops that may stay in country after most leave in 2014. And what triggered that particular standoff was a drone strike in Afghanistan against a guy on a motorcycle. Now, that strike also killed a young kid, along with this motorcycle rider. Now, I am not privy to the intelligence behind these drone strikes, but I think it's a reasonable conclusion that if it's a single guy riding a motorcycle, he is not a bigwig in the terrorist infrastructure. So what this tells me, bottom line, is that this whole business of drone strikes, even though they have been curtailed, there is still a real lack of cohesion on the part of the Obama administration. Cohesion that weighs military advantage against political consequences, which are invariably negative in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Crapon, co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Program. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 17 books, including Better, Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb, and his latest book is a collection of essays co-edited with Julia Thompson, Deterrent, Stability, and Escalation Control in South Asia. Well, there's no question that not only are these drone policies incredibly unpopular in Pakistan, they're also unpopular here in the United States with a lot of people, too. And they do elicit a lot of outrage. But in the case of Imran Khan, clearly he is not necessarily the best messenger, and he's not exactly using this outrage in a way that seems to be anything more to do with justice as much to do with some kind of peculiar self-promotion. And for a while there were rumors that he was even supported surreptitiously by the ISI. And as you know, Michael, the whole Pakistan is beset and absolutely mired in conspiracy theories. So I don't know what to make of what's going on, but it would seem to me the best thing that could happen here is for the U.S. to get out, which is what's happening, right? But this getting the equipment out is really the problem, and it seems that you can't leave all that stuff behind. That's just going to end up, creating the next war, which apparently is going to come no matter what, right?
Well, there's a great irony here in that Imran Khan wants the United States very much to leave. He wants us to leave the region. He wants us out of Afghanistan, as well as disconnected from the Pakistani landscape. But it's hard to do that while blocking the removal of armored personnel carriers and tanks and all the like. We have another way to get him out. It's more expensive, and it goes through Russia, actually, and some of the Central Asian states, but it's much preferable to get the stuff out the way it came, most of it came in, which is from Karachi port and then up landlines all the way through the passes to Afghanistan.
Well, I guess when we're sort of talking about this is what Hegel was negotiating with the new prime minister over, who was appointed his namesake as the new general, and Hegel also met with this guy, and they're basically, Hegel didn't say, you know, if you can't rein in Imran Khan, we're going to stop, you know, subsidizing the Pakistani military. He said, well, if you can't rein him in, the Congress is not going to want to pony up the money. But I think the broader issue always here is this very vexed relationship between these two countries and the extent to which Pakistan is this unique country in as much as it uses its nuclear umbrella as a way, you know, it conducts state terrorism under a nuclear umbrella. And this is the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. It's that in itself, I think, is the scariest part of it, isn't it?
Well, there are published reports in the region that suggest that between a fifth and a quarter of the funding for Pakistan's military comes through U.S. assistance. So that's a significant sum. And when the defense secretary says that these so-called coalition support funds are at risk because of this blockade, it's a significant incentive for the military leadership and the political leadership to find their voices. And to clarify national interest against this dynamic but mercurial political figure. As for the nuclear business in the region, we kind of lose sight of this because, number one, Afghanistan takes priority and getting out of Afghanistan takes priority. And then we have these not-so-small problems with Iran and North Korea. But in actuality, the nuclear competition on the subcontinent between India and Pakistan is the most dangerous competition by far in the world. We've added up the numbers, and in the 15 years since India and Pakistan tested nuclear devices in 1998, together, these countries have flight tested no less than 17, I'm not making this number up, 17 nuclear-capable delivery vehicles. Now, that's more. Both of these countries are now working with more nuclear weapon delivery vehicles types, not numbers, types, than the United States. Now, in this 15-year period, when they've moved forward with all of these weapon systems, they have agreed to actually three useful arrangements to try and damper this competition. Three. So they've agreed, for example, to give each other notification before they flight test a ballistic missile. And they've agreed to notify each other if they have nuclear accidents. These are useful agreements, but when you add them up and compare them to the competition in nuclear weapon systems, it's no contest. Diplomacy is lagging so far behind advancing nuclear capabilities and military doctrines, I might add. They're changing. It's not a good picture. And it's, believe it or, you know, we're having this conversation. There aren't that many conversations about nuclear dangers in South Asia right now.
But in spite of the fact that this is the most likely flashpoint on the planet, and if there's going to be a use of a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki, which mercifully there has not been, it's likely to be here, and it's likely to be on a pretty large scale. Or even worse, it's likely to involve some use of terrorism. In other words, or some transfer to terrorists, because this is the scary part about Pakistan's military policy, is that they use terrorism as a state instrument to level the playing field with the Indian military. It has vast more numbers, but if you use state terrorism under a nuclear umbrella in Kashmir and places like that, it's not a huge leap to suggest at some point in the future you might use state nuclear terrorism.
There is evidence, Ian, of changing attitudes about these proxies in the senior echelons of the Pakistan military. So young Pakistani soldiers, like our young soldiers, they have gone through two and three tours fighting against militants up along the Afghan border. So they appreciate more and more the problems of state sponsorship. Now, there are some groups that the Pakistani military are fighting today. There are other groups that they are not fighting. There's a group of militants that they're banking on to have a role in Afghanistan after most of our troops leave in 2014.
That's the Haqqani Network, right?
The Haqqani Network. They're
right.
not fighting them.
Right. Well, I'm pretty much we're out of time here, Michael, and let's have a follow-up conversation because, regrettably, this situation is not going away soon. And I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Crapone, the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and space security programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 17 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. And his latest is a collection of essays co-edited with Julia Thompson, Deterrent Stability and Escalation Control in South Asia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.